Ed Young was sort of receptive to the possibility of splitting some of the functions of the LMS college into smaller units. He told me once that if he could get Jim Watrous to head the College of Music and Fine Arts or something like this, he would be in favor of that, but nothing ever came of it. And ideally, I think the college should be split at least into a separate College of Science and a College of Fine Arts and a College of Letters, probably, to get the units and disciplines homogeneous enough that a dean could, in fact, be enough on top of the problems of the college so that he could make good judgments on allocation of resources between different departments in his own college, and then be an effective, informed spokesman for the problems of his college and the larger administrative councils. Harrington was never receptive to this idea. Part of it, I guess, was cosmetic purposes, that he didn't want to be in charged any more than he already was charged with multiplying the administrative function of the university, because this would require several deans instead of one. But I think it was probably more related to that he liked the larger amount of power which was inherent, I think, in administrator in principle, if he wanted to maneuver in having this big unit. And he also claimed, specifically as far as the physics problems were concerned, he could treat us better with physics as part of a big college than if it was part of a small one.
Did you actually talk to him about this?
Oh yes.
As a friend or as a committee chairman or department chairman?
I think one time Barshall and I went up and talked to him individually, I think, about it, to sound him out on the possibility. I don't think we ever wrote anything, mm-hmm. but I had also talked to Young about it. I think I talked to Elvin about it, too, one time. And the time we talked to Harrington about it was at the time that Ingram had resigned, and we thought this was an appropriate time to do it before a new dean was chosen. But he told us at that time he was sure that the dean he had in mind, Ed Young, would be able to be on top of the problems and would take care of physics. And indeed, we don't have any complaints about that period for our dealing with Ed Young. Was concerned, but I think the basic problem we posed did not go away, namely that it was even impossible for Ed Young, I think, in a period of declining budgets to make the sort of detailed judgments which would be required on where you allocate your resources.
You're speaking of Ed Young as chancellor.
As dean.
Was that a period of declining budgets?
No. That's why Ed Young was successful as dean. It was a period of increasing enrollments and increasing university support, and he was able to handle it because of that. But when conditions reverse, I say the problem is still there. It didn't go away. And the present deans, even if they had the ability and insight of Ed Young, I think have a much more difficult problem than Ed Young faced, because they have to make really substantive decisions on allocation of resources that I think Ed Young didn't have to make. And I think the unit is just a monstrosity now. There's no dean that can really be on top of it. Well, all this arose in discussion explaining how I had became chairman, I guess.
Was the problem of salary solved too when the money became easier?
Essentially, yes. The physics department was treated very well, I think, salary-wise during the subsequent period of Dean Young. In fact, and we did get higher on the priority list on buildings and finally got space on building. Those were the some of the problems which I worried about as I was associate dean later with Ed Young, was the space problem and salary problems.
Mm-hmm. But you'll be coming to that later.
Perhaps. Let's see. On the...
I think you were just going to say turn it off.
About the departmental problems, I think a more aggressive chairman and a more sympathetic dean than existed at the time of Rolfson and Ingram could have made the growth of the department certainly stronger, I believe, and avoided some of the problems. But I do want to say that I think Rolfson's judgment on staff was excellent, and in general his dealings with people were superb. I think his shortcomings as chairman that irritated some people was his inability to cope with lots of small day-to-day administrative matters, which the chairman really shouldn't have to worry about. And one of the changes which I made in department structure, which I think helped this, was the appointment of an assistant chairman. In fact, that was one of my conditions for taking the chairmanship, that there be an assistant chairman to help out on particularly problems where continuity is important, because I thought for the department's long-term health, it was probably not wise to have one chairman serve indefinitely. He loses energy and steam, and it's difficult for the department to change policy if it's traditional that you have the same chairman over a long period of time. So I wanted to get started a tradition of shorter terms as department chairman, a more rotating sort of department chairmanship. But this would only work if there is someone to carry the continuity needed on scheduling and classes and many of the day-to-day operations. And so this was one of the things I insisted upon, if I become chairman, that there would be an assistant chairman too. And I was very fortunate in getting as assistant chairman a former student to Connie Blanchard, who is
still
assistant chairman and associate chairman, who had a great deal of energy and very good rapport with graduate students. And I think he has served exceptionally well in this position. And it's only because of this that I believe our change policy of a rotating chairmanship has worked. I think it has worked fairly well. It has not worked quite as well as I had hoped in one respect. Namely, I had envisaged that a reasonable term for one chairman would be sort of the first year to learn the ropes, and then a couple of years to capitalize and exploit the experience before his energy and momentum had drained away, and with a 3-year sort of period, it would give still enough change on department policy and flexibility that...
That's the way most departments do it.
Yes. But for most of the chairmen, very few of them have been willing to serve more than 2 years because of the fact that it is such a burden that particularly the people that you want as chairman who are active in both teaching and research, their research program tends to suffer so much that they just figure they can't take more than 2 years of it at a time. So that, I've been disappointed that we've rarely been able to get anyone to serve more than 2 years, which means more of a turnover than is perhaps desirable.
I suppose in the sciences it's more crucial to miss an extra year of research than it would be in...
Yeah, your research program has a certain amount of momentum, but unless you can stay there, it can go downhill very rapidly. So this has been a problem.
And you yourself, how long did you serve your first term?
I think it was 3 years on the first one, and then I served as associate dean for 3 years, but then I got out of that. I came back, I served another 2-year term as a chairman, I believe. But I didn't serve 3 then, I think. My only other tour of duty came at the time of the bombing of Stirling Hall, when the regular chairman was away at Aspen in the summer, and Feeney appointed me acting chairman at the time to coordinate and tackle some of the problems involved there. And then I served as associate chairman during that period of reconstruction get the East Wing back in operation. And then I felt I had to go back to research because the department had wanted me to serve as chairman several years there, but with at the time of the bombing, our nuclear physics program was so badly hit that I felt I had to get back to the research area to keep that program going. The physics department, in its mode of operation, is perhaps one of the most democratic departments that exist. In fact, I remember a colleague from Michigan who was here for a colloquium, who had been chairman there, was completely dismayed and couldn't believe the way our department operated, from the extreme democracy with which, for example, salaries and promotions and recruitment were handled compared to other departments. It is really true that the department chairman is nothing but a chairman. He is not a head in physics and has relatively little power in the sense of being able to make decisions unilaterally. Recruitment, for example, is primarily by the groups that are involved. If it's high energy physics staff addition, they're out scouring the country to find a person, and they do the compilation of the documents and get the letters of recommendations and present it to the Department Executive Committee. On budget and salary matters, the department has always had an extremely democratic procedures for determining salary raises and promotions. When the department was smaller, the chairman interviewed every member of the department, and each member prepared a list of how he would distribute the amount of money that was available for salary raises, and it was essentially sort of an average of these, which was submitted. As the department got bigger, it was no longer physically possible for the chairman to individually take time to interview and discuss the research and teaching problems with each individual member. And there's a salary and promotion committee which divides this up now on the interviewing, but it's still an extremely democratic process. One change in recent years on department governance, two, was the organization of a departmental council, which meets once a week. There are elected members of the council from various disciplines, sub-disciplines. Well, actually not formally that, but there's a slate which is supposed to cover the various areas.
How many are there? Areas?
Well, I don't know about areas, but it isn't representation by areas, but the council has five members now, plus the past chairman, the most recent past chairman, to give continuity on it. And this council meets once a week, and it sort of serves as a cabinet for the chairman to give him advice on policy matters and, actually in some respects it's diluted the power of the chairman. There were some decisions which the chairman did make unilaterally before, which now seem to go to the council. Teaching assignments and things like this are discussed with the council. I think the council is only advisory, but it does seem to make it easier to get people to serve as chairman to have the council to go to for advice and to take some of the heat off the chairman if some of the decisions are not universally popular. If the council has approved them, it helps the chairman in that respect.
So it was developed as a help to the chairman rather than as a control on the chairman.
I think it was a little bit of both, probably. There's always some people in the department are unhappy with the way the chairman does it and does things, and I think the motivation of the council was involved both aspects.
Do you remember when it started?
That was fairly recently. I think it was less than 10 years ago. But
I wondered if it had to do with either with the unrest in the late 60s or with the TA.
No, I don't think it was associated with either of those. It does have the advantage that it does make sort of a training ground for a future chairman too, because they can serve on the council for several years and get a feel for what the problems of the chairman and department are, which they wouldn't normally have. So I think in that respect it's good. It tends to be more time consuming on the department's, the chairman's part than the previous arrangement, but
he has to go to all those meetings.
Has to consult them on all sorts of matters, which previously he did have things to decide himself. Although a good chairman would usually, on important things, informally go around and talk to people who would be most concerned anyway to get their advice and opinion ahead of time. It wasn't required formally, but it was certainly the thing to do, whereas now the chairman must consult with the council on major expenditures and things like this. So
I asked you how many divisions there were in the physics department.
We don't have divisions as such. Chemistry does have sharp divisions like this, but no, we don't.
You speak of the high-energy physicists and
there are, of course, but it spills over. It's not an organizational division. There are different subject matter areas, and there tends usually to be more cohesion between an area than across areas, but that isn't always the case.
Has there been anything like an age split or any kind of other kind of split in the department?
Well, no, the department, of course, experienced its rapid growth and the young people were added at that time, so that the age group, the whole department tends to be fairly young.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, one of the problems, that you don't have the normal number of older people retiring. It hasn't come to an equilibrium situation yet because of the rapid growth in the 50s and 60s.
That's off the subject. Are there department meetings?
Oh, yes. There are regular department meetings every other week. Friday noon we have a luncheon meeting at the club.
What club?
University club.
You do?
Yeah, in the downstairs.
You still do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
People gave that up.
No, this is every other week, and committee reports and council actions and policy matters are discussed there.
What percentage of the faculty go?
Well, most of them. It's a, as I said, democratically run department where people are very jealous of their participation.
Hmm.
No, it's usually a good turnout.
You wouldn't say that physicists didn't like to go to meetings then. I think somebody in the math department was saying that mathematicians.
I don't think they like to go to meetings, and they complain about the meetings being too long, but the agenda is always published ahead of time for the meeting, and with the council taking care of the more trivial things, the things on the agenda are usually things that people do want to put input in on, and they're very well attended, and it is a cohesive force in the department. And every other week in between, so that it fits to be a regular habit, the department has a social meeting. Sometime we meet with other departments or with postdocs or civil service or students, or just to, so that there is a regular Friday.
That's very interesting.
Luncheon.
Also at the university club.
Yes.
And
yes.
Do you pick a particular group each time, or just
yeah,
as a
no,
open house?
The chairman decides who to ask math department to come over.
How long has that been going on?
Oh, it certainly dates back to time when I was chairman, because I know I pushed it. I don't know whether... Well, we've had department meetings as far back.
Yes,
but the social things, I don't know whether I started that or not. I know I think maybe I did to try to... Well, physics department... oftentimes there were ill feelings towards the physics departments and other departments, partly because of jealousy, I guess, on research and financial support. Some of these social meetings were attempts for the department to become better acquainted with other departments, other departments become better acquainted with us. And I think physicists in general are interested in a broad variety of topics and like to get acquainted with people in other departments.
Now, did you include humanities departments?
Oh, yes.
Social sciences?
Yes.
Engineering?
Yes. The turnout varies a great deal, department to department, how many other departments will come. Some departments we have to give up on.
It might be rather hard getting them, having them become aware that they were invited to a physics department.
Well, their chairman should notify them. We go through the chairman of the department.
Mm-hmm.
But some departments we get good turnout and some we don't. but it has, it, if it's done too often, of course, it, one group isn't likely to have a good turnout, but if it's a long enough time cycle, it, it works out all right.
Excuse me, did you say somebody, do you ever give a paper, or does somebody...
No, we don't try to have a program. Mm-hmm. We try to make it completely informal. I think that's better than trying to have an organized program, something yeah. like that. So that...
Does the department gathering for the intellectual purposes, giving papers, a symposium?
Oh, the department has a weekly colloquium at 4 o'clock on Friday, where both outside speakers and local staff report on their work, and this is a cohesive element in the department. We insist that the graduate students come to this colloquium, and while we can't insist the staff do, we certainly hope and expect staff to come, and if the quality of the talks is good, the turnout is usually good. We tend to fill 1,300, which with, I expect the average attendance must be in excess of 200, something like that, staff plus students. And then depending, well, here are our announcements of meetings through the week. The Friday colloquium you see here, this was T.D. Lee from Columbia University. There's coffee and cookies ahead of time. And so it is a social gathering and a general department one. This was the last day of, and there wasn't a colloquium. There were no classes that day, but that was just a slideshow about his trip
and
to China.
And was that well attended?
Yeah, but that wasn't. That would include wives and civil service mm-hmm. and everything. That wasn't physics. That's not a colloquium, really. That happens to be on that Friday.
Yeah.
But the more typical colloquium, mm-hmm. you know, this from Stanford universities and Brookhaven National Laboratories, things like this. Each week the department puts out a colloquium and seminar notice so that you can go to whatever.
Who is organizing these? Is this the associate chairman's job? Or
no. The colloquium itself is a part of a teaching assignment for a staff member. He has to organize the colloquium and get the speakers and see that they're entertained and so forth. But the other seminars are the individual groups, plasma seminar, nuclear physics seminar, theory seminar, solid state seminar, material science seminar, astronomy, space physics, so forth. They're different groups, and they organize themselves. They simply put their notices, give the notices to the secretary in the department office, and each week we put out a notice of the events of the week uh-huh. so that the students and staff can go to the ones that they're interested
yeah.
in.
Do you feel that you're unusually active as a department in the university in gathering this frequently?
I guess probably that is true. I think that probably it's true, although I don't have...
I know the philosophy department, but that's a very small department, has
regular
meetings, but and has yeah. has a colloquium.
Okay. Some of the bigger departments, now I think chemistry no longer has a joint colloquium at all, but separate ones in their different mm-hmm. fields. We've tried to keep the joint colloquium because it is a cohesive influence for the department. Mm-hmm. Gives a chance to see and hear about work in other fields and outside the department and other universities. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, a very valuable function.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Keeps us in contact with the outside world, too.
And with each other. that as you would go and hear what a plasma
physicist
had to say.
Right.
I have only, unless you're still on this, I have one other subject on this department, how it functions. How much what is the attitude towards being chairman? Are there struggles to be chairman or struggles not to be?
The struggle is always not to be. I don't know of anyone who has ever wanted to be chairman who would have ever been considered.
Well, are there elections and are they disputed? That is, will two people be, will there be two candidates?
I don't ever remember of two candidates, no. The way it has been handled has been that, the way it's presently handled is that there is this nominating committee of the department who goes around and interviews people and sees what their wishes are, tries to get a consensus on individual interviews. The nominating committee first will try to find someone that they think is suitable. And if they will have checked with other people ahead of time as to whether he would be acceptable. And if they can persuade him to serve, then he will be nominated, and it goes, well, I think the votes are usually, I don't think they're hardly ever unanimous, but they're usually like 35 to 1 or something like this. There'll always be one or two that who don't approve of any particular person serving as chairman. But no, I think we have managed to achieve unanimity on chairman selections in the past, and it's also very important if the chairman is to function effectively that he have the support of the whole department. A person wouldn't want to be chairman, I think, under any other circumstances. No, as I say, the problem has been to get people who are willing to do it and who will do it long enough to really be effective. And it isn't something which has lots of rewards either financially or scholastically associated with it. So there isn't something that a person likes to do. And for a person who is power hungry, the way the department is set up, he would feel completely frustrated because it is not a powerful job. Although if a person has sufficient leadership, he can indeed change the direction of the department, persuade them, but there are a lot of strong-minded individuals in the department, and it wouldn't function as a headship at all or chairman at all.
There must be some a proportion of the department who never come to meetings and who remain aloof from all the department business. How big a group is that?
Oh, there's two or three, I think, of offhand. Some come to more or less, but most of them come regularly. One thing, the chairman assigns committees with the advice of council, and the committees include whole staff. Usually two or three committees, mm-hmm. and they have responsibilities which they have to discharge, such as preparing the master's examinations, qualifying exams, the prelim exams, student staff committees, library committees, various facilities, museums, lecture demonstration, introductory mm-hmm. courses. There's so that it is not a centralized sort of operation at all. It is decentralized, and department meetings, of course, there will be committee reports and recommendations from various of the committee programs, so that that is involved on that.
I don't see your name here at all. Are you released from this sort of thing? Oh, here you are.
Campus interactions.
Introductory courses,
introductory labs, and awards. Some awards committee that here,
yes.
You know,
yes, well.
There's some scholarships and various things like that.
I'm just curious, it occurs to me to wonder whether the chairman of a small department gets the same addition to his, gets the same rewards as the chairman of a large department.
Same rewards?
They get more, get released from class and get some more money, I think the chairman does.
The chairman gets no more money, no, absolutely none. I mean, there's no financial...
It's the summer off, is that it, the following summer, or in the following semester?
If he serves as summer chairman, he's paid for his serving as summer chairman.
No, I mean the regular chairman. Doesn't he, the year after he finishes being chairman, doesn't he get a...
I don't think it's automatic.
Maybe this is just a standard policy. I thought it was a campus policy.
I don't think so.
How do you reward your chairman?
We don't.
Not at all.
No, he doesn't teach his full load, usually,
but
most of them continue to teach.
He doesn't get leave the following year.
Not automatically, some in special cases he may, but it would be handled as any other staff member on that. Most of the staff have summer support on research anyway, so... and if the chairman has been chairman, he wants to get back to his research, so he usually is on research money in the summers.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think there is very much of this involved. It isn't something that people are fighting to do. It's regarded as a civic duty that you have to do occasionally. If you're going to complain about the way things are, you've got to be willing to take your turn to see what the problems are. And I think also, having had this rotation amongst quite a few chairmen, you have a large group of people then who are familiar with the problems and the limitations of the job and the frustrations, that makes life easier for a new chairman, because there are fewer irrational criticisms of his performance, because other people have been through it and know what the limitations are on it.
One more question, would there be competition among the different areas of physics, say for an additional staff member, that would lead to any bitterness?
Sure, there is competition, but
it's not serious, I bet.
Well, it hasn't been so far. Of course, it's only been recently that things were that tight, and we have not been expanding rapidly in this situation. The department did have committees some time ago which sort of outlined the priority of different areas for expansion, and we have tried to, we try in general to follow those criteria, but more important to the department, I think, on the average point of view, is not the field, but the quality of the person. If a particular group can come up with a really outstanding person, he will get more support elsewhere than if it's just a particular field. And I think this is still very healthy, although at times we have to emphasize the area more than the person, but ideally it would be the person. There was one problem, which there still is a problem in the department, which arose because of the fact that we were so short of space for many years that this precluded us almost from adding experimental physicists, because we could not provide experimental space for them, and you can't hire an experimental physicist unless he can have research space. As a consequence, in this period, we added a great many theoretical physicists, work with paper and pencil, and in my opinion at least, we are unbalanced in an ideal distribution because of this. We had hoped that we would get space sooner and then add experimental physicists to restore the balance, but by the time we finally got space, there was no longer the possibility of adding much staff, and as a result, I do think we are rather heavily weighted on the side of theorists rather than experimentalists, and this is something which I think we're suffering some from.
This would be like having all, all art historians and no artists in the art department. It wouldn't be the same.
It's not quite the same. It cuts across different areas, but it means that the emphasis is on the more formal mathematical part of physics rather than on the laboratory experiments.
Whereas in chemistry or botany, there would be no problem with space for an experimental scientist in those fields.
No, there would
right?
be problem there
no,
too.
There would.
But in biology, I don't think they have the theoretical biologists so much that where they don't need any space. I think they're essentially all experimental. In chemistry, they do have theoretical chemists who just push paper and pencil around, and but those usually are. Again, by particular areas, like here in physics, there's theoretical high energy physics, there's theoretical nuclear physics, there's theoretical solid state physics, and so they're in all different groups on area wise. But we, I think, tend to have an excess of the theoretical type rather than the experimental.
How do they find out whether the theories are going to work or not?
Well, experiments can be done elsewhere, but you can take experimental data from all over the world, but I think my own opinion is that we have an unbalance on this, and it's shared by some other members of the department. It also tends to make a little of a teaching problem in the department, in that the theorists are good on formal courses and mathematical courses, but most of them haven't worked out so well in the, especially for laboratory courses and the introductory general physics courses, where there are large element of lecture demonstrations. Now, there are exceptions to this. We have a couple of the theorists who are doing a good job on this, but it has pinched us, I think, in these areas to cover those courses. We will have to face that.
Sounds like a problem. Okay. Well, Herb would have been an experimental.
He is an experimental,
yeah.
Yes. Bright was a theorist. And Sachs, who's director of the Argonne Labs now, was a theorist. He was here over part of this period. Mm-hmm.
Is this a time to ask about any or attitudes in the department as between physics for industrial use and physics for, well, non-industrial use?
Yes. After the war, there was a great demand for industrial physicists, but also a great demand for academic type jobs and government jobs, and the better of the students tended to want to go, if they had their choice, and they did, usually of a dozen job offers, to choose the academic or government type jobs over the industrial jobs. This resulted in the fact then that the industrial people tended to be the poorer ones, and I think it has been unfortunate in this respect that, well, I think industry was soured somewhat on the type of people they were getting because they weren't as good as they should have been, and I think that has dried up part of the market. At that time, one couldn't even get good graduate students to interview most of the industrial people who were around. Now that the academic market has essentially dried up, of course, the only opportunities are primarily government labs and industrial jobs, and better people are certainly going in that area. I think Wisconsin has had a type of graduate program which I believe gave a good background for industrial applications, better than many other places where their training was often very highly specialized and I think perhaps not suitable for industrial applications. But one of the things that impressed me about the Wisconsin students when I first met at Los Alamos was their ability to design equipment and build it and debug it and operate it. And this, I think, was certainly, if not started, certainly nourished by Professor Herb's example and training, where he was exceptionally gifted on this, and he built the equipment here.
Okay, write it down.
So I think our graduate student training I think perhaps not suitable for industrial applications. But one of the things that impressed me about the Wisconsin students when I first met at Los Alamos was their ability to design equipment and build it and debug it and operate it. And this, I think, was certainly, if not started, certainly nourished by Professor Herb's example and training, where he was exceptionally gifted on this, and he built the equipment here.
Okay, write it down.
So I think our graduate student training has been well suited in general for a breadth which makes people suitable for industry and other activities, but it's only been in recent years that a large fraction have been going into industrial jobs.
Well, what I had meant was something that Herb brought up, when he spoke of having wanted to divide the department and have a department of applied physics.
Yes. Yes. I think part of Herb's reaction was to this problem that I mentioned earlier, namely that we have a predominance of theoretical physicists and we need a better balance on it. And I think he felt that the theorists were perhaps pushing the department too much towards the formal side and not enough towards the experimental emphasis, and that the department should be more vigorous in that area of applied physics. And I think there is some sentiment in the department for this, but I think, well, it varies from discipline to discipline. I think, in our own field of nuclear physics and Professor Herb's area, this was essentially applied physics, and there's other areas which are similar in this respect. And if we have enough staff in this area to handle these sorts of students, I think it's probably better to keep it as one whole department rather than split into two separate departments on it. But if conditions got too bad, I suppose it could be a split. There are schools with separate departments of applied physics.
You said Harvard had
Harvard had that. But they don't have an engineering school, and the applied physics corresponds to engineering.
Yes, he did. It did.
Yes.
That was. So this was not any sort of conflict in the department as to whether this should happen or not. It was merely an idea that he and others had. Or did it ever come up? Was it debated in department meetings?
I think it's been mentioned a few times, but I don't think it's ever really been a serious proposal.
Mm-hmm.
There was some talk at one time when we had difficulties with the LNS dean that we would be better off in the College of Engineering because it's a smaller college and they would be cognizant of the problems. In fact, in many departments, universities, that is the case. Illinois, it's in the Department of Engineering, the College of Engineering, and in some schools, it's in both Letters and Science and Engineering College. And I must say, well, at the time this was sort of proposed, we were less than enthusiastic about the Dean of Engineering, so that sort of killed it. Present Dean of Engineering is quite a different caliber person, and there is some talk now that we might be better off in the College of Engineering.
Would they be glad to have you?
I would think so. We have certainly prestige and reputation and research money. I would think they would welcome us with open arms. Professor Barshall, who shifted from nuclear physics to 90% nuclear engineering, is very well pleased with the engineering college, and contrasts the accessibility of the dean over there with the inaccessibility of the dean in letters and science, and the fact that the dean is aware of what's going on and what the problems are there, whereas the dean is not in the LNS college.
Would this be a major wrench? If something like this happened going into another college, or for instance, would it affect graduate students? It's not just the title on the door.
No, I don't think it would be a major wrench. I think it's administrative one, budget one, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
The department determines its own policies, independent of which college it's in, and the graduate school requirements are just for the whole university, mm-hmm. not for college.
Yeah, that's true.
So, no, I think there wouldn't be any dramatic wrench on the students at all.
Is the physics department one of the more expensive departments because of equipment it needs, or in LNS?
I guess it depends somewhat how you do your bookkeeping on any sort of thing like this. At the time I was in the dean's office, the cost per credit hour was highest, I think, in music, and physics was down lower. Now they do their bookkeeping somewhat differently up there, and I think Pheasant Physics may be higher per credit hour, but it depends how you count things. And then a basic difference, of course, is whether you count research as graduate education or not. The money that the physics department has on research from outside sources, I think, is of the order of, I think it's still of the order of $3 or $4 million a year from outside sources. And the university collects overhead of about 58% in salaries of the money spent there, so a fair fraction of that goes into overhead, and some in fringe benefits and the others in equipment. So the outside support of physics department is large compared to any other college in L&S, much larger than chemistry, and last time I saw it's large compared to engineering too, all engineering college. It's not large, I guess, compared to medical, but it's then a question of how you allocate costs and receipts. It's a very difficult question to say just what the cost is. The lighter teaching load in physics is compensated partially by the large lecture sections and the use of TAs in the lab, so that I think our cost per student credit hour in introductory courses is relatively low. I haven't been in the dean's office since early 60s, so I don't know what the situation is now, but I do know that there have been changes in bookkeeping on how they charge certain things, whether they charge, at one time, the physics lighter teaching load was charged against research, and another time it was, and it's since been charged against teaching. And so you'll get quite different figures depending upon how you do those. So I don't know the answer on that. I haven't seen.
Is there any chance that the money would stop coming in? That is, I understand that plasma physics is coming up as the.
It has all the money, I guess more money than they can, they have more students than they can handle with present staff, and they're most in need of staff additions, and they have gotten, there have been certainly no reduction in their budgets or shortage in their budgets. We have tried to add staff position. We made an offer to someone last year, but he turned us down. We're again very choosy upon who we add, and this was a high-level position, but he didn't come. So they're still looking for people that short staff there. The high-energy physics, actually, the plasma physics budget, I don't think, is very much larger than ours for the physics part. They also have worked in nuclear engineering and electrical engineering across lines. High energy physics budget is probably the largest single group. They have most staff, and that's related to experiments at National Accelerator Lab at Batavia and at Stanford and at CERN and Brookhaven, and so they have a lot of travel and they're away a lot. And this sort of research has been the biggest problem for the department, in that it becomes very difficult to mesh such requirements with teaching a regular course if they have to be away for an experiment and back. And it's a terrible life for the people involved, too.
Are they away for a semester at a time or less than
that? No, less. The experiment may be scheduled for a week or something, and then or the machine may break down. You can't schedule things always the way you'd like, and so that is our most difficult teaching and problem, I guess, is the high energy physics problem.
I guess I didn't make my question clear. I was wondering if money might stop coming in.
The question of hardness and softness of the money. Well, this is always a problem on any outside research support. I can say in the nuclear physics area that we have had this contract since, I think, 1947 or 1948, and if you have a good program, it tends to be supported, although with time, areas of interest to the government change, and this certainly could turn off in principle at any time.
That's what I was wondering, whether it was changing.
The fraction of the national effort in low energy nuclear physics, which is essentially ours, has certainly decreased. Our program suffered tremendously by the bombing both on staff and students, but we did survive that. Other areas actually have suffered more on dollar-wise. The fluctuations in support have been worse than solid-state physics, I think. But as long as you have lots of different sources of support, you tend to sort of average out. If one dries up, another one comes on. And the main thing is to keep a quality program going. And we have the additional advantage that we have in principle backup from WARF, from a good deal of support, which they provide seed money to get new things going.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been one of the big advantages Wisconsin has had.
It's all right. I made this mistake.
Yes, I had expected with the general decrease in federal research funds that our departmental research activities would be squeezed more than they have been. But the total dollars, I think, have remained about the same. Of course, inflation means a net reduction in activity. The main effect has been that we've reduced the number of graduate students from our peak of around 250, I think, down to around 140 or 50, so that we're supporting fewer graduate students, and graduate enrollment is down then, and a larger fraction of them then will be on teaching appointments rather than research appointments.
Mm-hmm. When you say you have reduced them, they were reduced, or you?
Well, we've reduced them mainly by not adding as many new ones each year. You see, it's semi-automatic. If a person loses research support and he has some students to support, then we put them back on teaching, and it means there are fewer teaching vacancies for next year. So we admit fewer. We hire fewer outside teaching assistants.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is sort of self-correcting that way. And over the period of years, from, I don't know, when the drop started, 68 or 69 federal funding, but we've gone down from a high of around, I think, around 250, I say, to around 150, something like that. And the teaching assistants, I think, constitute about I would guess around 25 or 30 students. So most of them are still research. Mm-hmm. Maybe more than 30, but I don't. And there's some not on appointment, but on their own. But, most of them have some support.
Well, next time we'll talk about the teaching assistants. That's one subject I'd like to cover. But is there something more you want to add generally to department affairs?
I might just remark about building committees. This is a university and statewide and national problem, I guess, is the proliferation of paperwork and committees and barriers and red tape. I was in charge of the building of this east wing of Sterling in 1957-58, whatever it was, and we handled it very well by a meeting once a week with the architect. We came over from Milwaukee and we went over things and we made our suggestions and changes, and he went back and we got a very functional building out of it. But I was also chairman of the building committee on the new building here, the Chamberlain Hall addition, which occurred in, I'll just forget the dates on it, but at least the whole operation was just a tremendous contrast. It was illegal for us to meet with the architect alone, building committee. We had to have representatives of the state architect's office, engineering, physical plant, university architect. You have a group of 20 people or something like this, and you can either rubber stamp what the architect does, or if you try to make changes, it delays things forever.